It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Kennedy.
I'm Bill Hemmer.
I'm Sandra Smith, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Wednesday, June 22nd, 2022. I'm Dave Anthony. He was a doctor trying to heal on TV. Now he's a candidate trying to win in Pennsylvania.
I think I speak for a lot of Americans who have woken up one too many days with a sense that there's anxiety in the country that's addressable. And so I'm going to do everything I can to help.
We speak with Republican Senate nominee Mehmet Oz.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. The Southwest is literally running out of water, and federal officials say they may have to step in if people don't start reducing water use on their own.
We're reaching the breaking point in our ability to use water and sustain our communities here in the whole southwestern United States.
And I'm Colin Reed. I've got the final word in the Fox News Rundown.
We're still in the middle of primary season, setting up the 2022 race for Congress that Republicans hope ends with them in power again.
If we are able to win a majority, that's how we're able to govern.
House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy told Fox Business,
if we are fortunate enough to win 35 Republican seats, that would be the largest Republican majority in more than 100 years.
But the 50-50 Senate could go either way. One big target for Democrats, Pennsylvania, hoping to replace retiring Republican Senator Pat Toomey. John Fetterman is their candidate, but the lieutenant governor hasn't campaigned since right before winning the primary, when he suffered a stroke, saying back in May with his wife Giselle by his side,
it was on Friday. I just wasn't feeling very well, so I decided, you know what, I need to get checked out, so I went to the hospital.
I need to get checked out. Yeah. Because I was right, as always.
Now, he is still in the race as he recovers, and ahead in a new poll of Dr. Mehmet Oz, the Republican nominee.
It sounds nice, but it actually is a lot nicer because and I was warned about this, in the primary, it's basically character assassination.
Dr. Oz won the primary after a recount.
You're going up against people you agree with generally,
right,
but you have to argue that you're a better person and carry the banner, carry the message. In the general election, which is where we're in now, I get to talk about policies. I get to talk about legislative issues. I get to talk about the things that are really bothering Americans day in and day out. And these topics we'll get to in the interview, but they're ones that immediately attract everyone's attention. So it's less like being in fifth grade.
Okay.
And more like being in high school.
All right. So you've graduated. Is it? Like I breathe a sigh of relief. Is it easier? Does it feel different? Do you feel more comfortable now?
It's not that it's easier. It is more comfortable. It's what I wanted to do. It's why I went into the arena of politics. I spent my whole life, as you, speaking to people, trying to connect, making sure the stories that I'm sharing with them elevated them, bringing guests into their lives that could get them to think differently about opportunities and challenges. And in the political world, at least I want to do the same thing. I'm a healer. I'm a doctor. So my goal has always been to empower people, to get them to challenge authority when it made sense, to empower themselves with information. And when you're running in a general election, particularly in a time like this, when there's such clear differences between the far right and the far left, and there's a lot of room in the middle to help people, it's tailor-made for someone like me. And so I enjoy it a lot. I get up in the morning and I don't have to memorize my lines. I know exactly what themes I think are important in the lives of people I'm trying to help. And I can go hard on those topics. And it works for that reason.
How hard is it, though, after that fight with those other Republicans, to try to get them on board with you?
Absolutely essential. And it has been much easier than I expected. I really thought there'd be hard feelings or folks who are reluctant, take some time.
I mean, David McCormick lost by less than 1,000 votes. That's very close.
Yeah, and imagine being in that situation. Yet he was gracious in his concession. He's a professional. He has a future, I think, in just about anything he wants to do. But the ability for him to bounce back from that and to make it clear to everybody in Pennsylvania that the battle happened, we fought hard, but it's over. And now we got to unify around one candidate. First of all, means the world to me and my effort, but it also means a lot to Pennsylvanians because he put their interests above his own. And, you know, he endorsed me, but he also contributed financially, which is an important additional step, which he recognized would symbolize to everybody. It's time to stop what happened in the primary and move forward. Jeff Bartos, who also was one of my fierce competitors, is one of my campaign co-chairs. Ambassador Carlos Sands, has done events with me. So it has allowed the party to heal. And when you spend a lot of money hitting each other, it hurts. You leave scars. But like siblings, if you can make up, your bonds are even stronger because we were forged in the same furnace. And now we are laser focused on what is a true, I think, clear and present danger in Pennsylvania, but also to our nation, which is a candidate, John Fetterman, who's far to the left of Joe Biden. Remember, Joe Biden grew up in Scranton. He's a Pennsylvania kid.
Yeah, so more of a blue-collar, old-fashioned Democrat, the people have said.
He used to be. I mean, he's moved clearly far to the left of what he thought he would be and what we all thought he would be. And that's sent a clear message to a chilling message to a lot of Democrats in Pennsylvania.
So you say John Fetterman is farther left, more Bernie Sanders-like.
In fact, Bernie Sanders is a specific example. He endorsed Bernie Sanders in 2016. He called Bernie Sanders, together with him, the two most progressive candidates in America. He's endorsed socialized medicine, where you to get rid of private insurance, and it's not something the Pennsylvanians want, but he's also done other things along the way, like arguing for more spending, which in this case, the reckless spending, as you know, has worsened our inflation, but it also represents that you're not willing to make the harsh decisions. You're not willing to own up to the reality that you can't just throw money at a lot of these far-left social programs. You actually have to have a game plan, and you have to have an agenda for prosperity. But most importantly, in Pennsylvania, he's taken a stance against energy, which for the entire country, I think, is a mistake because it hurts our energy autonomy. It hurts us in international relations and hurts our ability to maintain national security.
All right.
And it infuriates Pennsylvanians enough so they'll vote Republican. Even conservative Democrats, who again culturally are Democrats, these are JFK Democrats from Wilkes-Barre, Scranton, where Joe Biden's from, for example, they're going to vote for me on the Republican ticket this year. And they may stay Republican because they're so frustrated by how far left the Democratic Party has been pulled. They're not against the Democratic Party. They're against the far left elements of the party that don't seem to honestly be able to debate these issues.
Okay, but you mentioned John Fetterman, your Democratic opponent. He's the lieutenant governor. New USA Today Suffolk poll, which I'm sure you saw. He has a 9-point lead over you. And in that same poll, it listed your unfavorability at 50%. So what do you have to do to change minds? What message do you have to do to sell yourself?
Well, in medicine, you learn about tincture of time. Sometimes the patient's going to heal just fine on their own. After having had $40 million dumped on my head of negative advertising,
okay.
It does tend to drive up your unfavorables.
All right.
And it also divided the party. So the poll was done literally as soon as the Secretary of State confirmed that I was the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And not surprisingly, a lot of Republicans haven't healed yet from a contentious primary. So that's going to happen naturally.
Right. 10% of them, I think, were supporting Fetterman.
Yeah. More, 20%.
Okay. So you have to get their minds back changed.
Right. And it's going to happen naturally, especially as Democrats attack me, which they are now. I have two goals right now. Make sure that conservatives, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, understand my family values are their family values, and we have to govern from those values. And I have to remind them that Joe Biden has lurched to the left, in part because he doesn't believe in the innovativeness of Americans. He doesn't believe in the grit that we have. And if you don't believe in the innovativeness and the ingenuity of Americans, then you don't believe in America. And when you have a candidate running opposite me who's further to the left of Joe Biden, it reminds them that this is not a path we're happy with. 75% of Pennsylvanians do not like where this country's headed. So they want change. Who's the candidate to change? Who's the outsider? It's me. John Fetterman is the insider candidate who's already established himself as one who's willing to cripple Pennsylvania businesses, which they have done. And as lieutenant governor, he helped lead that charge. He wants to release 1/3 of all prisoners from inmates, which is in a time of turmoil where we have a crisis of safe streets in Philadelphia, the biggest murder spree ever in the city's history. Why are you releasing 1/3 of prisoners and arguing against life sentences for murderers? These are things, again, that seem disconnected. In a time when we know that we're having more and more fentanyl drug overdoses and more illegal immigrants, why would you make the border porous, which is what he's argued for, open border, plus sanctuary cities in Pennsylvania? So all I've got to do is stand by these realities and smile, and they will naturally gravitate to me. But what I'm going to do most importantly is reach out to every corner of the state. I'm in Philadelphia talking to urban populations. I'm talking to suburban women, groups that historically have shied away from Republican ideas, saying, listen, I love you guys. I care about you. My policies will help you more.
Now, Dr. Oz won the primary after an endorsement from former President Trump,
who's under a lot of scrutiny by the Democrat-led House committee investigating the Capitol riot. At yesterday's hearing, GOP Congresswoman Liz Cheney put the focus on
President Trump's effort to overturn the election by exerting pressure on state officials and state legislatures.
Democrat Adam Schiff says that pressure
was a dangerous precursor to the violence we saw on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol.
But the former president still insists the election was rigged and told a rally in Mississippi on Saturday, the probe's fake and phony.
We call it the insurrection hoax. It's a hoax because it was not an insurrection.
Dr. Oz, like most Republicans, isn't paying much attention.
Well, January 6th, there were criminal actions in January 6th, and there's a legal system, and I believe in that legal system's ability to prosecute appropriately people who broke the law, and they should pay the price. If you didn't break the law, you shouldn't. I'd love to see that level of interrogation to what went down on January 6th.
Okay.
But I'll tell you, when you're out campaigning every day as I do, this is not top of mind for Pennsylvanians, whether they're Democrats or liberals. I'm sure there are people who are captivated by this, but they are worried that they can't go on vacation. 70% of Pennsylvanians are changing vacation plans because of energy prices. They're frustrated that they can't have their communities thrive because of ideological issues that block energy, which they know is natural gas, for example, able to be cleanly harvested from the ground and build value in their communities. These are all issues that that's what they're thinking about.
Okay, so no one's asked you about the former president, the last year's riot, his involvement, none of that?
I get asked about it all the time on media.
Okay.
Very rarely when I'm sitting in a diner.
So people like me are the only ones talking to you about it.
Well, yes, and I'm sure people are thinking about it. It's just not the number one thing they're thinking about. What they're really worried about are that day's problems. And again, I'm talking about what the typical conversation you have when you're doing a town hall. And believe me, I'm out there all the time. And I explicitly try to get people on the left and the right together. I mean, again, I'm talking to union leaders. They're not asking me about January 6th. Mm-hmm. They're saying, what are you doing to make sure that we have a wage that we can raise our families healthy with and pay taxes and build our communities? And what are you going to do about make sure we have jobs? Their existential fear is that by shutting down the energy economy of Pennsylvania, you'll cost them jobs directly. These are the building unions, for example. Mm-hmm. But in addition, you're going to shut down manufacturing in Pennsylvania. I was visiting a company that builds big distribution centers for like Walmarts of the world. They can't find diesel fuel. It's not about the price, but they actually can't find the fuel. Now, that is a whole different level of crisis. Yeah. That means I actually have to lay people off because we can't go to work. They're paying stipends to help them drive to work. They're not asking me about these other issues about that happened in 2020, especially because I wasn't involved in it. They're asking me, what are we going to do to deal with the clear and present threat that they're not going to be able to run their businesses?
When you sit back sometimes and reflect, is it hard to believe what you're dealing with right now? I mean, you were a doctor doing well on television. Here you are in the middle of a race. Half the people are giving you an unfavorable rating. It has to feel different.
My wife always wonders why this is so. Maybe my prefrontal cortex is shaped differently. I don't mind criticism. Most of the aggressive criticism isn't about me. It's the person who's angry. And they have a right to be angry. And they direct their anger at me. But that's okay. I could not have lived my life with the blessings my family received from this country. Remember, my parents are immigrants. They were welcomed here. My father's a doctor. He was recruited to come to this country. I could not have lived my life, having done as well as I've been blessed to do, not fighting to make sure our country was healthy. The silver baton my dad handed me in the race of life, I've got to make it just as shiny for my kids and my grandkids. I think I speak for a lot of Americans who have woken up one too many days with a sense that there's anxiety in the country that's addressable. And so I'm going to do everything I can to help. There are many, I believe, who don't realize their voice is that important. It does have an influence. Say what you see, others will do the same. If one person puts their hands up, they'll get shot. We all put our hands up, can't shoot us all.
Dr. Mehmet Oz, Republican nominee for Senate in Pennsylvania. Thanks very much for joining us.
God bless you.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
This is Colin Reed with your Fox News commentary coming up.
Last August, the Bureau of Reclamation, which is within the Interior Department, issued its first ever water shortage for the Colorado River. 40 million people rely on that river for much of their water supply. The Bureau of Reclamation warned this will likely be an ongoing narrative due to climate change. And last week, Bureau Commissioner Camille Tutin told Congress that a huge reduction in water use is now needed.
There's so much to this that is unprecedented, and that is true. But unprecedented is now the reality and a normal in which reclamation must manage our systems. A warmer, drier West is what we are seeing today.
The Public Policy Institute of California says the Colorado River supplies roughly a third of all water for Southern California cities and suburbs, as well as farms in Imperial and Riverside counties. Southern Nevada, including Las Vegas, gets 90% of its water from the Colorado River. In May, the Arizona Republic reported that the city of Phoenix gets 40% of its water from the Colorado River. And Arizona farmers are already suffering, according to Phil Bashaw, CEO of Arizona Farm Bureau Federation.
You're talking about multi-generational farmers, folks that have had these farms in their families for many, many years, and they're concerned. I would anticipate additional resources being needed to mitigate the impacts of the drought and the cuts that we'll have to take along the Colorado River if those cuts get deeper.
Now, Lake Mead, the nation's largest reservoir on the Colorado River, is shockingly low, the intake valve is showing. And when the Bureau of Reclamation Commissioner announced the amount of cuts needed to avoid catastrophe, water officials were concerned, to say the least.
The commissioner's announcement Tuesday was, I think, stunning to those of us who work on and think about and depend on the Colorado River.
John Fleck is writer in residence at the Utton Center at the University of New Mexico School of Law.
That is a huge volume of water that we need to reduce. And it's going to be really difficult to get there. But it's also this really frank recognition of how bad the situation is that we're in, how empty the reservoirs are, you know, the combination of drought with warm temperatures, with climate change layered on top of it. We're reaching the breaking point in our ability to use water and sustain our communities here in the whole southwestern United States.
We actually have some visual evidence, right? That intake valve at Lake Mead being the country's largest reservoir, you can actually see it now. And we do know that there are lower intake valves that have been created in preparation of this because many saw it coming. But Lake Mead dropping rapidly at 28% capacity. Lake Powell's much lower as well. And to be specific about the amount of cuts the Bureau is talking about, the commissioner said 2 to 4 million acre feet. 1 acre foot is roughly 326,000 gallons of water. So yeah. When you say that you were stunned, I can't even wrap my mind around that amount. I mean, I'm thinking like an ocean's worth.
Yeah, it's so hard to make sense of it. You know, how many Olympic swimming pools or, right. But the bottom line is that we in the Western United States for a long time have been living on bonus water, surplus water, the extra water in these reservoirs from wet periods in the past. And we can't do that anymore. And so to translate that into the lives of people, this means the cities that depend on the Colorado River are just going to be browner. We're going to have fewer lawns and fewer trees. And the farm communities that depend on the Colorado River's water, there will be less irrigated land in those farm communities. There's just no way around this. We're using too much water and we need to scale back. And this has been a problem for a long time, but climate change is making it worse.
When they say 40 million people rely on water from the Colorado River, does that include farmers? And that's not 40 million people. Their entire water source is from the Colorado River, right? There are other sources.
Right. So that's 40 million people who get at least part of their water supply from the Colorado River. So we can take my community of Albuquerque, New Mexico, as an example. We have available water from the Rio Grande. We have available water from groundwater that we can pump out of the aquifer, and we have imported Colorado River water that we bring through a series of dams and tunnels. So when we lose our Colorado River supply, and it's going to be very scarce this year, we go to other sources of groundwater. If you're in a city like Los Angeles and San Diego, you have water from a number of sources. The Colorado River is one of them. But this is 40 million people in 7 states in the United States and 2 states in Mexico, and 5 million acres of irrigated farmland across the western United States and down into Mexico that depend for at least a part of their supply on the Colorado River. And remember, all the other supplies that we depend on, they're shrinking too.
Yeah, exactly. I want to get into that, and I want to get into solutions in a minute. But fighting over water. As a California native, you and I are both from Southern California, so we've paid attention to this, you more than I, but it's always seemed sort of mysterious or nebulous. Water politics can make people's eyes glaze over, unless you're, I guess, watching Chinatown, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
But when we talk about sort of the pecking order, right, there's 7.5 million acre feet go to upper basin states like Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, where you are, and the same amount goes to Arizona, Nevada, and California. 1.5 million acre feet goes to Mexico. But within all of that, there are like water rights. There's senior water rights, junior water rights. California, due to negotiations over the years, gets more of this water than Arizona does. And so those first cuts, when we talk about cutting, those first cuts go to, like, at least in the lower basin states, go to Arizona, right? And we're already hearing from farmers about that, right?
Yeah. So we have this very complex pecking order for the distribution of water. So what we've seen, because the farm communities have the highest priority rights, but the urban communities have a need for reliability of supply, what we've seen is these collaborative relationships, not really fighting. I mean, there's some conflict involved, but these collaborative relationships where the cities will compensate farm communities for reducing their use. You know, cities will help pay for more efficient irrigation systems or pay a farmer to fallow a field, meaning not plant completely. And that conserved water then can ensure the reliability of the city's supplies. And, you know, in most cases, the city's uses are actually going down, right? Municipal water conservation in the Colorado River Basin is an amazing success story. So it's not like the cities are just hogging more and more water. Everybody's using less. It's just that the available supply is going down even faster.
Right. John, the Bureau of Reclamation Commissioner told Congress last week they are choosing right now to act as a partner to states and water districts and farms, but they warned they could act unilaterally. What does unilateral action at the federal level look like?
First of all, an important point. We have seen in the history of Colorado River Basin governance over the last 20 years, this same pattern. The federal government has to threaten, and then the states fall into line and come to an agreement and figure out how to share a shrinking water supply. I expect that to be what happens again this time. The federal government has a number of legal authorities that would allow them to reduce the amount of water that they release from Lake Mead for farms and cities downstream. They have the legal authorities to do that. They would prefer not to, but at some point, like, they're finding dead bodies in Lake Mead. It's low. At some point, the federal government has to step in and be the adult in the room and say, you all are not doing enough voluntarily. We need to protect the long-term viability of this system with some more immediate and more extreme short-term cuts than you all have been willing to do voluntarily.
But should the flip side of that be some other solutions? Like, if you're going to sign a bipartisan infrastructure law, should some of that money go to increasing water storage, especially if we're hearing that it's going to be less snow, more rain? Should there be discussions about alternative solutions? Like, what should the discussion be in terms of solutions going forward?
Sure. I would say all of the above. We are going to spend money to build desal plants along the coast, more of them than we've ever done before. We are going to build, in cases where it makes sense, more storage. We are going to get better at storing water underground, spreading storm water. We're going to do all of those things, but that doesn't yield enough water to solve the real problem. And there's a bunch of money in the infrastructure bill to work at some of those problems. But the scale of the shortfall of water in this system on the Colorado River, here in the Rio Grande, those shortfalls are so great that there is no concrete and pipe fix for it. It's about using less water, ultimately.
Using less water. Even some who know to do this and have done it successfully before struggle. Just this year, Californians increased their water use at one point despite pleas to cut. And it's on the minds of water educators like Laura Ramos at the California Water Institute at Fresno State University.
You know, I think people are still learning what a mega drought means, what it means to be in a drought, and what it means and how it affects you or you as an individual, because the drought is affecting the environment, agriculture, and communities. And so when the governor says reduce water, I don't know that everybody in a home knows how much water they really use and what is it. You know, I know that I turn on my dishwasher and I know that I do this many loads of laundry and this is how much water I put in my grass. But I don't know that everybody knows exactly how much that means. So to them, they could be thinking that they are reducing the amount of water usage, but in the total, it might not be. So I think it might take a couple of months for people to realize how much water we use on a day-to-day basis. There are other sources, there are other solutions, but it's not going to be one solution. It's going to have to, because the drought is so big and it's affecting so many different areas, it's going to have to be a plethora or a buffet of all of the different solutions. It's going to take water treatment plants, this new infrastructure. It's just not going to be one solution. But also including in some of those solutions is not just the infrastructure and the tangible things, but the working together between all of the different stakeholders that use that water. So it is farmers working with communities, working with legislators, working with environmental advocates, and all of them coming together so that we can say it's one water and not just water for ag or water for people. It is water for California, water for the United States. It's water for everybody, and learning to work together to divide that pie or work together towards solutions.
But are you hearing policy-wise of anything concrete? Like, so what, when you think of like concrete policy solutions that are happening right now or that are being talked about right now, are there any?
Yes, there are. There are actually some, you mentioned earlier, subsidence, or that the land is shrinking or sliding down due to groundwater recharge. There are two points in our biggest canals, the Delta Mendota and the Frank Kern Canal, that have what we call pinch points. So the canals move water through gravity, but if the ground in a higher end sinks, now the angle at which that water moves is no longer there. And so those canals are not able to move as much water as they were meant to. And so there is current legislation and funding to fix some of those pinch points in the canals, because they were only moving, I think, 50 or 60% of the water they were made for. So there are some that are going to help short term, and then there's need for longer term solutions.
Laura Ramos, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And in other news,
I'm Gianna Gelosi. Millennials get a lot of slack for a lot of different things. One is the fact that they choose pets over parenthood and homeownership. And a new study is showing just how deep those roots run. A recent study by Consumer Affairs surveyed 1,000 pet owners and found that 57% of participants aged 27 to 42 love their furry friends more than their sibling. Half of respondents say they love their pets more than their mom. Boyfriends and girlfriends don't even stand a chance. Millennials' romantic partners come in second to a pet for about 30% of the people that were asked. According to the survey, millennials make up the biggest share of pet owners in the U.S. and spend more money on their animals than any other age group. One in four millennials said they would be willing to even sell their car to afford a life-saving procedure for their pet. Now, we already established that millennials, like myself, are not as much interested in home ownership, but we're going to speak in hypotheticals right now. So if you were looking for a pet-friendly state for you and your furry beloved, Maine is the most pet-friendly state in the country. New York is the least. Maybe some helpful information for the 75% of millennials and 89% of Gen Z folk who say they are influenced by their pets' needs when choosing a place to live. For the Fox News Rundown, I'm Gianna Gelosi.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Rate and review the Fox News Rundown on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Colin Reed.
What's on your mind?
Like tsunamis in the ocean, political tidal waves form after a seismic interruption. Something there has been no shortage of in Joe Biden's America. It's ironic for the man who promised a return to normalcy. On Biden's watch, words like inflation and supply chain have gone from esoteric terms in academic textbooks to daily problems around kitchen tables. Everyday necessities have become unaffordable or unavailable. Against that backdrop, voters will head to the polls in less than 5 months to render judgment on the Biden administration. The first midterm is never fun for the party in charge, but this one looks like a five-alarm fire. Here are five reasons why. First, Biden's support among Hispanics, a voting bloc he carried by a 2-to-1 margin in 2020, is cratering. While this trend isn't new, a Quinnipiac University poll earlier this spring showed his approval rating among Hispanics at just 26%. With illegal border crossing apprehensions hitting new all-time highs, turns out voters are looking for a new direction. Second, gas prices are soaring, the administration is out of answers, and no relief is in sight. It would be a politically deadly combination heading into any summer driving season, even more so for a country yearning to travel post-lockdown. Instead of solutions, Biden and crew continue to borrow a page from the Elizabeth Warren playbook by demonizing the private sector. Third, the inflation Biden and crew dismissed as transitory has come roaring back. On the heels of last week's 8.6% uptick, the Federal Reserve announced its most aggressive interest rate hike in nearly three decades. Remarkably, Biden remains in denial about inflation, dismissing concerns as, quote, lies about reckless spending. Fourth, Biden has lost the ability to scare voters. His dire warnings about, quote, MAGA Republicans do not pack a punch when the stock market has shed $11 trillion and taken retirement accounts with them. Finally, and perhaps worst of all, doubts about Biden's age and ability are no longer related to his partisan critics. Even his fellow Democrats are openly musing about the next chapter. Stating the obvious, former Obama advisor David Axelrod raised eyebrows when he described Biden's age as, quote, a major issue. The embattled White House press office is already fending off questions about Biden's reelection prospects. The succession jostling has already begun, which ironically may be Biden's saving grace. Any list of would-be standard bearers consists of the retreads, Democratic Senators Amy Klobuchar and Cory Booker, the extremes, like U.S. Senators Warren and Bernie Sanders, or Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or those associated with the failures of the current administration, such as Vice President and Border Czar Kamala Harris, or Transportation Secretary and Supply Chain Guru Pete Buttigieg. For all the ink spilled on the future of the GOP, it turns out the Democrat bench is utterly devoid of talent. That's not exactly a compelling message to carry into battle, but it might be Biden's bet to shore up support from wavering Democrats. I'm the only chance you've got. Less than halfway through his first term, the man who came into office having received the most votes in history and relishing comparisons to FDR and LBJ is a walking lame duck. And that's before the political tidal wave hits the shore. I'm Colin Reed, a Republican strategist, former campaign manager for Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown, and co-founder of South and Hill Strategies.
Listening to the Fox News Rundown. Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.